All right, some people are asking, again, what's a paradigm shift? I want to encourage you, if you have questions, we have a question and answer box there on the back of the registration table. You can write those down, drop them in. We'll be answering those during the second half of every night. Again, paradigm shifts are not the world around us, but how we look at the world. It's the lens through which we see the world. It's the map through which we try to navigate the territory. Not the territory itself, but the map. The picture I had of my dad was of this uninvolved, uncaring, just distant man. Was that how he really was? No, but was that my paradigm of my dad, my picture of my dad? If it helps you, just think of paradigm as your picture of something, the way you look at something, the way you see it. Jesus spent his entire ministry, I am convinced, trying to affect paradigm shifts. He told stories like the Good Samaritan. Was that a paradigm shift for people? Yeah, because they didn't see Samaritans as good. And he talked about the Good Samaritan. That was a paradigm shift. Jesus, we're going to continue to look at some of these paradigm shifts. What I want to focus on for a little bit tonight is that Jesus did not seek to affect paradigm shifts in people, a change in how they saw things. He did not seek to affect that through changing their doctrine. If you think about his life, this picture we get of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is that Jesus went about trying to create paradigm shifts through inviting people to embrace a radically different way of living, a radically different moral ethic. It stretched them. We're going to be looking at that, the ethical teachings of Jesus, because behind the ethical teachings of Jesus is significant paradigm shifts and how we view this being called God and how we view ourselves and how we look at everyone else. And if we can experience those paradigm shifts through the ethical teachings of Jesus, my hunch is that we will find deep relevance for these five areas that we put on the screen earlier tonight. But again, why even look at it? I mean, why look at the ethical teachings of Jesus? Why even give Jesus the time of day anymore? Most people say it's antiquated, it's irrelevant. Today, when we look at the violence and the abuse that religion is creating on planet Earth, today many people's solution is to throw out God, religion, all of that entirely, which would include the historic person, Jesus Christ. Now, I understand why they're doing that. To a large degree, religion does produce violence on this planet. How many would agree with that? William Temple, he wrote, take your hand out with me. He wrote this question. He said, if our concept of God is wrong, what's he talking about? Your concept of God. What would we call that here tonight? Your paradigm. That's right. Some of you are paying attention. Your paradigm. If the way you see God, your picture of God, your concept of God is wrong, he said, the more religious we get, the more dangerous we are to ourselves and others. If you agree with that, say yes. G.K. Chesterton, he's known for saying, the teachings of Jesus have not been tried and found wanting. Christianity proves that the teachings of Jesus have been found difficult and left untried. I want to be very clear. What I'm about to say is not an apologetic. It is not a defense of the religion of Christianity or the Christian religion. This event, Life Unlimited, is not about a religion. It's about a person. It's not about attaining post-mortem heaven. It's not about escaping subterranean hell. This series is taking a serious look at the ethical teachings of Jesus that pertain to how we do life today in the here and in the now, and asking whether or not there's any relevance in those today. The things we do know about the Jesus story, the indisputable facts, somewhere in the first half of the first century, there were these 11 men that traveled the countryside telling this story about this Jesus. They claimed that he was the Messiah. They also claimed that he was the Son of God. They also claimed that he did miracles. And they also claimed that he had died. And what did they say happened after his death? Raised back to life. The question I want to ponder this evening is why? Why did they do this? You've got three options when we look at this topic. When we're questioning the relevance of Jesus, the practical nature of his ethics, if there's anything intrinsically valuable to these today, we have to go back to the Jesus story itself and ask, why would these 11 men do this? And once again, there are options. Number one, the most popular answer today is that that's not really what happened. These guys, you know, it's like a fish story. You know what I'm talking about? After telling it over and over again, it just began to be exaggerated and it became not the Jesus story, but the Jesus legend. How many have heard that explanation of the Jesus story before? Let me see your hands. Okay, two of you. Only two of you. Really, you guys need to get out just a little bit more. All right. The other option is that these 11 men, when Jesus died, they wanted to do something to honor him. They revered him. And so they got together and they wanted to create a religion in his name. And so they got together and they just made up this story about Jesus. That's called the lie theory. How many have heard that version before? They just made it up. All right. One of you has heard that version. The last one, which I'm hoping many more of you have heard, is to simply say the reason why the story was circulated by these 11 men is because this story actually took place the way they were telling it within history. How many have heard that version before? All right, everybody in the room's heard that one. Good. And you do have a pulse. That's good to see this evening. Indisputable facts. They went out and they they began telling the story in a very hostile environment. They began in Palestine and then in the larger Roman Empire, and persecution breaks out almost immediately. That's point number three. They suffered a lot of persecution for this story. And number four, the basic message of these early Jesus followers we find in those first century documents of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the earliest Pauline epistles, or the letters from Paul. So let's take a look at these three theories and see how much weight each one of them has. As we're looking at these three theories, they're all three theories. You cannot prove any of them beyond a shadow of a doubt. How many realize that? All three of them you cannot prove scientifically beyond a shadow of a doubt. Now, what we need to do is look at the evidence that we do have and look at the trajectory, the direction that evidence is pointing in. Most places, not this one, not this location, because I only live about 4 hours from here, but most locations that I go to, I have to fly to. How many would agree that getting on an airplane these days takes some level of faith? It's an act of faith. How many would agree with that? All right, there's three things you have to believe in. Number one, you have to believe that the pilot is actually competent and sober. Number two, you have to believe that the mechanics have done their duty. And number three, you have to believe that TSA is competent as well. Is there anybody here that works for TSA, by the way? All right, okay, that last one, I can say this then. That last one is probably the most difficult for me, being a frequent traveler. But if I get on the plane, can I prove, with the evidence that I have, can I prove the competency of the pilot? No. Can I prove that the mechanics have done their job? No. Can I prove that TSA has done their job? No. But I look at the evidence that I have, I look at the direction that that evidence is pointing in, and what do? I get on the plane. That's called a rational belief. It's a belief still, but it is rational in the sense that it's in the direction of the evidence you possess. What would happen if I got onto the plane and I saw the pilot stumble into the cockpit with a fifth of Jack Daniels? I saw parts of the plane falling off, and I saw little dudes running away from the plane after attaching little blinking red lights, and they have remote controls in their hands. At that point, given the evidence that I have, would it be rational to believe that the pilot was competent and sober, the mechanics have done their job, and that TSA was competent? Would that be rational? Now, could I believe that? Yeah, I could choose to believe that in spite of all the evidence. But that would be what kind of a belief? Irrational. Irrational belief is still a belief, But it's a belief that looks at the evidence, looks at the direction of the evidence, and chooses to believe the exact opposite of the evidence. That's what we need to look at this evening when we look at each one of these theories. Is this theory rational or irrational? Let's look at the lie theory first. Again, that's the one that says the disciples wanted to do Jesus some type of honor, so they made up this whole thing about him to honor him. They wanted to create a religion in his name. The first question we have to ask is what they would ask if we were bringing this into a court of law. What motive would they have to do this? If you are accusing someone of doing something, if you accuse someone of maybe committing murder and that's taken to court, the first thing the judge is going to ask you is what motive? If you agree with that, say yes. What motive would they have had for this? Think of it this way. If they were like the TV evangelists today within the Christian religion who were making lots of money off of the Jesus story, would they have motive for telling this story? Yes. Is that what happened, though? No. What does history tell us happens? As a result of this telling this story, what happens to these 11 men? Their life isn't improved by this story. Their life is actually ruined by this story. How many would agree with that? I mean, they end up losing everything for telling this story. They end up losing their lives. Peter, we're told, his spouse was executed with him. They watched their spouses lose their lives. They watched their children be persecuted and some of their children lose their lives. What motive would they have for telling this story? That's the first question we have to ask. If you think of some of the more secular historians like Tacitus, how many enjoy, you stay up late at night reading Tacitus? I mean, he's one of your favorite authors. Anybody here? No, because he's quite boring. He was a historian in the time of Nero, and he himself was not a Christian, but he felt sorry for Christians when he looked at how Nero treated them. Nero would and I know this is gross, but it's just history. Nero would take Christians alive, impale them on a stake, dip them in oil, light them on fire, and use them for the outdoor lighting for his festivals and his parties. A Roman candle is not a firework in South Carolina. It's a burning Christian during the time of Nero. That's how Tacitus felt sorry. So when you think of the fact that they lost everything for this story, do they have a motive for making this up? No. If anything, they have a motive to what? Talk to me. You have to keep quiet, to not tell the story. That's right. Question number two we have to ask is, could they have pulled this off? Not only was it heretical to say the things they were saying about Jesus within a Jewish context, not only was it threatening to say those things in a Roman context, not only did they die for this story dealing with motive, but let's say they actually could pull it off or try to, could they have done it? What's the likelihood that they could have made up this story, sold it to everyone in that time, to the point that it became the kind of threat that Nero saw it to be in just a few short years? Could they have pulled that off if they were lying? Think of it this way. Could it be easily falsified? If you were making, this is not a story that took place long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. This is like a story that virtually took place 2 years ago here in Asheville. And they mention big names. They mention people like Caiaphas, the high priest. They mention Pilate, the governor. They mention Joseph of Arimathea, which would be the equivalent in America of a U.S. Supreme Court judge. They mention these big names, and they're right here local in the same town, and they're all still living. If these guys were making up this story, could they go and talk to the people that are mentioned in the story and find out whether the story really happened or not? Could they do that? Do we have any evidence, and this is huge, do we have any evidence from the first century of people doing this, tracking down, talking to the people, and finding out they had lied? Do we have any evidence of that? See, the second thing they're going to ask you, if the first thing is motive in a court of law, what's the second thing they're going to ask you for? Evidence. And a theory is a great theory in and of itself, but every theory, for it to be proven, requires... How much evidence does the lie theory have to prove that they were actually lying? It's a neat idea, but how much evidence is there that the disciples were lying? None. which is really hard for some of these postmodern, the naturalist worldview, because even the enemies of Jesus, people want to say today that these 11 men made up the stories of the miracles. How many realize we live in a naturalistic worldview where everything can be explained by natural cause and effect, the supernatural is looked upon negatively? How many realize we're living in that kind of a world today? Today, what people want to say, they made up the story. Even the miracles, they made those things up. Those are exaggerations. Those are, you know, he didn't really raise the dead. He just kind of nursed them, or, you know, he didn't really heal the sick. He just helped the sick. They want to say it was all made up. Even the enemies of the Jesus story agree that yes, Jesus did miracles. They just said he did it by the power of demons. How many find that interesting, that even the enemies agree that the miracles took place? If there's anybody that has something to lose from this story, it would be the enemies of the story, and they even agree. Another thing we have to consider is James. James, who was the brother of Jesus, hated Jesus during his life. He had a great animosity towards Jesus because it was Jesus' responsibility. When Joseph died, it was Jesus' responsibility to take care of mom and the rest of the kids. Jesus, instead of respecting and playing the cultural role and taking care of the family, what did Jesus end up doing instead? According to the story, what did he end up doing? Yeah, he left his family and went teaching through the countryside. He became an itinerant teacher. Is it any wonder that when James writes his letter in the New Testament, James defines religion as taking care of who? The fatherless and the widows. How many have read that before? That's true religion. This is James's context. Now, what I find interesting is if this is a lie, how does James go from being the brother of Jesus, hating Jesus, to beginning his letter by saying, James, a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ? That's a question that has to be asked, doesn't it? How does that happen if they're just making it up? I mean, if anybody knew they were making it up, wouldn't it be the brother of Jesus, James? Wouldn't it? And he goes into believing it. Again, could you go and find out whether this story had happened or not? Was it local enough and recent enough that you could have tracked it down? Absolutely. And you have zero evidence. Matter of fact, you have evidence in the opposite direction. Question number three we have to ask, if they're lying, if they're making this up, once persecution breaks out, when any time there's a story that's being lied about or made up, once people start being persecuted for this story, what happens every time? Talk to me. What happens? You have deserter. How many know anything about the history of Mormonism, early Mormonism? Everything in Mormonism, nobody here knows anything about Mormonism. Nobody? Okay, early Mormonism, okay, some of you. This is engagement time. You can talk back to me, all right? Early Mormonism is established on the test. Everything's established on the testimony of three witnesses. There's three witnesses that saw the angel Moroni give the golden tablets to Joseph Smith. As they begin to migrate west during the early days of Mormonism, by the time they get to the Midwest, Mormons begin to start practicing polygamy. Now, folks in the Midwest don't really appreciate polygamy, so the persecution becomes really intense. When the persecution intensified for the Mormons, guess what happened to two out of those three witnesses? They said, maybe we didn't see that angel give those tablets to Joseph Smith. Think about Watergate. How many were alive and remember that? All right. How long were they able to keep the Watergate lie going? 2 weeks. 2 weeks. 2 weeks. And I would remind you that no one's life was endangered. No one's spouses were being threatened. Nobody's children were being threatened. The only thing they were in danger of is being imprisoned for a short period of time and maybe some financial penalties. But 2 weeks, and John Dean couldn't keep his mouth shut any longer. How many remember that history? How do you have 11 men telling this story throughout the first century until their life is taken from them for this story? And not one of them, if it's a lie, not even just one out of 11 men comes forward and says, maybe we made this whole thing up. How many think that's significant right there? You don't have any deserters at all. Whatever you say about the disciples, you can say whatever you want to about them, but whatever you do say about them, you have to at least say this. They genuinely believed. They had seen what they saw, and they were willing to die for what they said they had seen. That, to me, holds a lot of weight. Anyone else, if you agree, say yes. Number four, you have to ask why the Gospels read the way they do. And this is more minor, but even in the details of the Jesus story, you've got things that are very countercultural. Like, who are the first ones to find the risen Jesus in the Jesus story? Women, that's right. Who are the first ones to proclaim that Jesus has risen in the Jesus story? Women. Can you tell me why is it the women? Where are the men? Hiding. Why are the men hiding? Because they're a bunch of cowards. Okay, the treatment of women alone by Jesus in the Jesus story, according to first century Jewish standards, is breathtaking. How many would agree with that? And the fact that you're going to say 11 men made this story up, and the way that it reads is that men were cowards and women were the first ones in that culture to proclaim a risen Jesus. How do you explain that? If 11 Jewish men made up the story, I would submit to you that is not the story they would have made up. How many can see that? It would not have read like that. So you've got other problems there with the lie theory. I'm submitting to you tonight that when you look at the evidence, although that you cannot prove any of these theories beyond a shadow of a doubt, the lie theory just doesn't seem to go in the direction of the evidence we have. If you can see that tonight, say yes. You can believe in the lie theory, but that belief by definition would be an irrational belief when you look at the evidence. That is why most scholars, and I was at Princeton University last spring, two springs ago now, spring last year, and one thing that I appreciated was that most scholars today, even secular scholars, if they're going to deny the historical reliability of the Jesus story, they will all say that the lie theory is not a viable option for explaining it, though, either. All educated non-believers in the Jesus story, all of them don't believe the lie theory. How many find that comforting tonight? There are some conspiracy theorists out there that buy into it, but to a large degree, the educated world, the scholars, say the lie theory doesn't have any evidence whatsoever. The second one, which is where most of the educated, those who don't follow Jesus, the educated fall into, is the legendary theory. So let's ask some questions about that. And we're just going to ask some honest questions. The first one, take your hand out with me, it's page 2. The first question we have to ask is, how do orthodox monotheistic, what does that word mean, monotheistic? They believe in one God, one deity. How do orthodox monotheistic Jewish men go against their most fundamental convictions within their own culture? And they begin to worship a contemporary Jewish person, a contemporary Jewish carpenter, mind you, one of their peers. They begin to worship him as the embodiment of Yahweh himself. I had a professor once say, "Herb, come on. Buddha was an atheist, but his followers revered him so much that over time they began to see him as God." Isn't it possible that it's not too far of a stretch that these Jewish men revered Jesus so much that after a while they begin to define him as God too? How many would be willing to say that on the surface that really looks like a really neat argument? How many would say that looks valid? Yeah, it looks valid. Alexander the Great was claimed to have been divine. How many understand that? Yeah, those arguments look valid. But let's look at it. I think when you talk about Buddha and you talk about Jesus, you're not dealing with apples and apples between the two scenarios. You're not even dealing with apples and oranges. You're not even dealing with apples and aardvarks. They're two totally different things. And we'll start with this. Let's look at the cultural differences between the two. Where Buddha became God, what was the culture in which Buddha, who was an atheist himself, What was the culture in which Buddha arrived at divine status? Number one, were they monotheistic or polytheistic? What does polytheistic mean? Many gods. Were they monotheistic or polytheistic? They were polytheist. They believed in many gods, so when Buddha becomes God, he doesn't become the God, he becomes a God. So that is relevant. That affects it somewhat. So he becomes a God. Something else you have to realize about the culture, within this polytheistic culture, did they already have legends of people, of humans becoming God and gods becoming humans? Did they already have these kinds of legends within the Buddhist culture? Yes. So they were used to this kind of thinking to begin with. Are you with me? Go back to Jewish monotheistic fundamental Judaism, first century Palestine. Were they used to making people God? Were they used to saying God became a person? Would this have been a new thought for them? Not only would it have been new, they were surrounded by Greek culture, the Jews were. And was Greek culture filled with stories of human beings becoming God and gods becoming human beings? Yes, full of those kinds of legends. And what was the attitude of monotheistic fundamental Jews in first century Palestine? What was the attitude of them towards these kinds of stories? Positive or negative? Very negative. So much so that they had safeguards in their culture to prevent legends like this from ever getting off the ground in Judaism. What was one of the biggest deterrents to saying someone was God within their culture? What was it? There was a penalty. What was it? Stoning. If you take away the stoning for a moment, let's just call it execution. Death. If you even started moving in that direction, what was the penalty? Your life was over. It was the death penalty, capital punishment for even moving. How many would say that would be a great cultural deterrent from ever claiming to be God? How many would agree with that? Let me try to illustrate it this way culturally. If we went to a third world country, and a developing country, let's say, and they'd never seen a white person, and I'm the first white guy they'd ever seen, and I'm different, and I looked at, would it be easy or hard? And let's say they're very superstitious, they don't know anything about modern technology, they're very religious, very superstitious, would it be easy or difficult for me to convince them that I am God from some faraway place come to them? Would that be easy or difficult? Pretty easy. Because of the culture. It lends itself towards that. What if I came to you tonight here in the South, in America, in a westernized culture, technologically advanced, and I come to you tonight and say, for you to get anything out of the next 7 days, you're going to have to get over this hump tonight. You have to believe that I, Herb Montgomery, am coming to you as God incarnate in the flesh. I am God. Easy or difficult for me to sell you on that? Very difficult. How many would say next to impossible? How many would? That is the difference between Jewish culture in the first century and the culture in which Buddha became God. Do you understand the difference between those two cultures? One culture lends itself to a human being becoming God. The other is dead set against it. Look at John 19:7. We have a law, and according to our law, he must what? Die because it's right here in your handout, because he claimed to be the, what does it say? You have to understand these 11 men, for them to start worshiping a Jewish contemporary of theirs as God, nothing was more antithetical to their Jewish upbringing. They had to go against everything they had ever been taught to believe, to embrace that Jesus was divine. How many think that's astounding right there? That produces some problems. The second problem is, you have to ask this, how does that happen in that culture? How does that happen overnight? See, Buddha, how long did it take Buddha to arrive at divine status in that culture that leaned in that direction anyway? How long did it take him? Do anyone know? It took Buddha 500 years to arrive at divine status, and it was only within one sect of Buddhism that it took place. Alexander the Great arrived at divine status. How long did it take Alexander the Great to become divine? 400 years. That's right, 4 centuries for people to start saying that about him. With Jesus, you don't have 500 years. You don't have 50 years. I can make a pretty strong argument from the oral traditions that you don't even have 5 years when it comes to Jesus. Jesus comes out of the chute overnight, fully divine in a culture that is dead set against anyone ever doing it. He doesn't grow into divinity. He comes out from the beginning of the story, fully divine. How many think that produces some questions? It's just a question we have to ask. How does it? Because whenever a legend, for it to be a genuine legend, what does a legend require? Time. It has to be told and retold. That's right. When you look at this, look at 1 Corinthians 15:1-8. Stay with me. It says, "Now, brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel that I preached to you, which you received, on which you have taken your stand. By this gospel you are saved, if you hold firmly to the word I preached to you. Otherwise you believed in vain. For what I have received, I passed on to you as of first importance." Now, so is he giving them anything new at this point? Talk to me. We just read it. Is he giving them anything new? No. He says, "I'm just telling you what I already told you, what I preached to you already. I'm reminding you of it." It says, "For what I received, I passed on to you." So what I'm talking about isn't, this is the first time, this isn't number one, the first time I've ever told you. Number two, when I did tell you, it was given to me, so it pre-existed even my telling you. And then he goes on to say that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was, what does it say? Raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and he appeared to who? That's significant because that's the early Aramaic version of whose name? Peter. That's right, an early reference to Peter. And then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than how many? 500 brothers and sisters. What does it say? At the same time, most of whom are still what? What does he mean by that? Most of whom are still living. What is he saying? You can go talk to them. They're still alive. Now, some people say it was a hallucination, those who saw Jesus. It says here, how many saw Jesus all at one time? Is there anybody here that remembers the 60s? No, you don't. Never mind, you'll get that later. 500 people see Jesus all at the same time, and you're going to tell me that was a hallucination? 500 people have the same simultaneous hallucination? I want to know what they were smoking back then in the first century. That's a pretty high claim. See, what secular scholars all agree on is that 1 Corinthians 15 is the earliest record we have of the resurrection. They date it in the early 50s. Now, when did Jesus, according to the story, what years, be liberal, what years did Jesus die and resurrect in? How many would agree early 30s? If you agree, that's how the story, right? Early 30s. So you got early 30s and you've got this record of it, which again, this record, was he introducing it to them in the early 50s? He was reminding them of what he had already told them in the early 50s. How many can see that? And he's not only reminding them of what he already told them, he's saying that he was actually told to me before I told it to you. So we don't know how far back it actually went, but you've only got how many years there at max, if you're being liberal, how many years do you have between the event and the first record we have of the event? You've got 20 years, you've got 2 decades. With Luke and Acts, Luke is volume 1 of volume 2. With Acts, you've got... Acts is a strange book because Acts was written by Luke as well. But if you've ever been reading the book of Acts and you come down to the end, has anyone like me ever wondered where is the ending to this book? It kind of just falls off a cliff at the end of the book. Anybody ever notice that? There's no ending to the book of Acts. It just stops. What is also interesting about the book of Acts is that Luke is very interested in Jewish-Roman history, and the Jewish-Roman war between 67 to 70 isn't mentioned. Paul's execution in 64 AD isn't mentioned. There's lots of things that aren't, the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 isn't mentioned in the book of Acts. What would be a logical explanation as to why Luke doesn't mention these things? They hadn't happened yet. So you'd have to date the writing of Acts early 60s. How many years is that from the events that took place? That's 30. That's only 3 decades. And notice Acts is volume 2 of Luke. So we assume he would have written Luke first. We would have to say early 60s for Luke as well. That's still 30 years for that Jesus story. Now, some people will say, well, Herb, 20, 30 years, a lot can still become exaggerated in 20 years. Well, sure it could if we were playing broken telephone. And that's how most people think about the Jesus story. This guy told this guy, then this guy told this guy, then this guy told this. Would there be room for things to get changed if that's the way it worked? If I were to start up here and say Donald Duck to the person on the front row and just tell you to whisper that in everybody's ear and didn't tell you, by the time it went all the way back and traveled back around here to the front, it could be the U.S. Constitution by the time it gets back there. Could it not? Yeah. So how do we know that 10 years, 20 years, 30 years wasn't enough for us to lose the Jesus story? Stenographers today have gone back to oral tradition communities who, before they could write, they passed on their histories orally. And the way they did it was like this. You would have a crowd in the room, much like the crowd we have tonight. Then you would have an orator who stood up front. His job was to tell the history. If there were first-time hearers in the room, they would be hearing the story for the first time. But there would also be old-timers in the room that had heard this story umpteen times. If this guy began to veer off and start making up things or exaggerating, what do you think those old-timers would do? Yeah, correct him. Pull him back into, you know, the truth of the story. What stenographers have been able to prove is that within oral communities where the histories were told like this, is that histories can be told and retold and retold for up to 150 to 200 years, and the significant details of the story never change. How many think that's really significant? How much time do we have? The only reason we have written documents is because this community that were believing this Jesus story that was being told over and over again, they were the evangelists that would tell the euangelion, they were the orators. The only reason we have the written documents is because, remember, what was happening to these people for following this story? Do you remember? They weren't getting rich. What was happening to them? They were dying for this story. And the witnesses were beginning to die off. So they said, we need to write this story down. So they began to record it. And once they recorded the stories, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they gave them back to these oral communities. And how did these oral communities receive these written versions of the story? Did they receive them negatively or favorably? Very favorably. And did they have a heightened interest in making sure that these written versions were the same as the oral versions that they had been dying for and that their friends had died for? Did they have an interest in making sure this was the correct story? And this community embraced these written versions that were written within this community. Mark 15 says, a certain man named Cyrene was Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus. How many realize how significant that is? If he's saying, hey, listen, this guy Simon, hey, he's the father of Alexander and Rufus, what's he mean by that? Read between the lines. What is he saying? You guys know Alexander and Rufus. He's a contemporary of yours. Their dad. That's one generation. How many think that's significant? That is not enough time for a legend of this magnitude to be created. Question number three. Every legend requires a cultural catalyst. The legend of King Arthur. The legend of King Arthur. Why did the legend of King Arthur, why was it born? Why did it come into existence? Well, because the Anglo-Saxons were losing their history. They had lost their history, and they needed something to bind their culture together because their culture was beginning to unravel. It was becoming disunified. And so they come up with the story of King Arthur because of that cultural catalyst. Was there a cultural catalyst during the first century for a legend about a Messiah to be made? Was there a cultural catalyst that could have created a story about a Messiah? Talk to me. What was the position of Israel? They were in bondage to who? Rome. Who were they looking for? A Messiah, and the Messiah was going to come and do what? Liberate them from Roman oppression. Is that enough of a catalyst to create a legend about a Messiah? How many would agree that's enough of a catalyst? Yeah, that's a catalyst to create a legend. Now let's ask question number two. What would a legend produced by that catalyst look like? Any ideas? would it have looked like this? The Messiah has come. By the way, he broke almost every rule that Moses laid down in calling himself God, Jehovah. And not only did he that, but he actually went up against the Romans. The Messiah has come. He went up against the Romans. And guess what? The Romans won. We're still under Roman occupation. Do you want to follow this Messiah? How many would agree that if a legend was to be born from the catalyst that existed, it would not have been a legend that read like that? How many would agree with that? So yes, you could say a legend could have been born, but this is the wrong story. This is the wrong legend if you're going to say it's the legend that was created from that cultural catalyst. Question number four you have to ask is, how do you reconcile the claim that this story was a legend if they're claiming to be giving eyewitness testimony? Look at 1 John. It says, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, which we have seen it. He has appeared to us. We proclaim to you that we have seen and what we have seen and heard. This is the message that we have heard from him and declare to you. Listen, if it's a legend, but someone's standing there saying, I saw it for myself, and it didn't happen the way he says he saw it happen, at that point, it's not a legend. A legend is someplace where all of the eyewitnesses, where are they today? They're all dead. That's where you have a legend, where things become exaggerated. If someone is telling a legend, and at the same time, they're saying, I'm an eyewitness to it, I saw it, and it's not true? That's not legend. What is that? That's a lie. How many would agree with that? If someone's saying they saw this happen and they didn't see it happen that way, that is not exaggeration or legend. That is lying. And what did we just say? That's why I don't think there really is anything. There really isn't a legendary theory if you've got eyewitness testimony, because you've got the eyewitnesses having to lie about it for it to be untrue. And how many saw tonight that the lie theory is the most implausible when you look at the actual evidence? How many saw that? And the legendary, if you listen to the eyewitness testimony part, turns into very quickly not a legendary theory, but another version of the lie theory. How many can see that tonight? So there's no evidence for a lie theory. This is why Wolfgang Schadenwalt, and this is a remarkable document. Wolfgang Schadenwalt is the world's foremost scholar in Homeric literature, Greek literature. And his job is to go back into historical documents from early civilizations, Greek civilization. And his job is to assess whether or not the document is communicating history or whether or not the document is communicating legend. Are you with me still? Have I lost you? Okay. That's his job. The seminary at Tübingen, Germany, which is the most liberal seminary on the planet, they invited Wolfgang Schadenwalt because they wanted to prove once and for all that the Jesus story is fictitious. It is legend. That's what their job was. They brought him in. This is what you're hired to do. Take Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the synoptic gospels. Take those three and put them through your tests. This is what Wolfgang says. As someone who has acquired some knowledge considering literature, I am particularly concerned here to note, when we read the Synoptic Gospels, we cannot be other than captivated by the experiential vividness with which we are confronted. What does he mean by experiential vividness? What does that mean? There's a vividness to the descriptions that is not present in legends. The vividness of the descriptions can only be that vivid if someone was actually there experiencing it. Are you with me so far? So he says, we can't be other than captivated by this. He says, the conditions of their time stand before us. Nature, the landscape of Palestine, the Sea of Galilee, places from the coast to the far side of the Jordan, Nazareth with its sheer cliff. If only we read the text simply enough, we can imagine Jesus traveling here and there, a situation which we misunderstand if we miss the repeated other way. The most important words are spoken, the actions performed on the way, as no more than literary decoration. This is the key point. I know of, how much does he say? No other area of history writing, biography, or poetry where I encounter so great a wealth of material in such a small place. What is he saying by that? He's saying, if you're looking for evidence to believe this is historically reliable versus a legend, I am the world's foremost scholar in this department. And I know of no other history writing where I find this much evidence that it is history rather than legend. I know of no other documents that I've ever read that have this much evidence in this level of concentration. How many think that's astounding? That's a secular expert saying that. Even he wrestles with the legendary theory because the evidence doesn't point in that direction. Listen, tonight we can debate the truth of the story details, whether they actually happened or not. All I want to simply put before you is that the lie theory isn't as watertight as some people would like to say it is. How many saw that tonight? The legendary theory isn't as persuasive as people say it is. How many saw that tonight? When you take the Gnostic Gospels of the 3rd and 4th century and the 2nd century, when you take the Gnostic Gospels and you put it through these academic historic tests, there's 9 or 10 of these tests. Do you know how many of these tests the Gnostic Gospels fail? All 9 or 10 of them. When you come to the Synoptic Gospels and you put those through the tests that historians put ancient documents through, do you know how many of the 9 or 10 tests the Synoptic Gospels fail? Take a guess. 1. It fails 1. It passes the majority of them, but it fails 1. Do you know which one it fails? The Synoptic Gospels contain story details that are supernatural. How many can see that? And the moment you see supernatural stuff happening, the assumption is this must be legend. You could go that way, but for you to explain the supernatural by a legend, how many can see you've got all these other questions that that now creates that you can't answer? How many see that? The legendary theory is not an easy option. It's difficult to believe the legendary theory. Now, I would also submit to you, it's difficult in our culture today to believe that those supernatural things really happened. How many would agree with that? It's difficult to believe that, too. The question you have to ask tonight is, which one is more difficult for you to believe? That it's a legend that took place in the context and the timing that that happened in that culture? Or that maybe, and this is the option that I'm wishing more people would take, especially with the supernatural, the story details. How many realize that with light, we can't explain light scientifically? How many realize that? Is it a particle or a wave? The only answer is yes. And can we explain that? No. Entangled electrons, if you don't know about them, I don't want to bore you. But science can't explain why they work the way they work either. I would think a more plausible, and I know this might be oversimplified, but a more plausible explanation could be that if we're seeing something in the Jesus story that we can't explain by science, a more plausible, open-minded approach would be to say, well, maybe scientifically we don't know yet how everything really works. How many would be willing to say that? We might not know everything yet. Okay, so that's possible. We could do that. But even outside of the story details, do you know why people want to believe it's legend today? This is going to be hard for you to hear. Do you know why people want to believe it's legend today? It's because of the way Christians have abused the Jesus story. Rather, it's the way Christians have abused others with the Jesus story. Are you hearing what I'm saying? You see, if you go back to the 4th century, and I don't want to spend much time here because we're going to be talking about this in further nights, but this will make sense to you and it'll make this series make sense to you. In the 4th century, there were significant events that took place within Christianity that caused the ethical teachings. What part of Jesus? The ethical teachings to be marginalized and abandoned. Up until the 4th century, what made you a Christian was whether or not you endeavored to follow the ethical teachings of Jesus, i.e. the Sermon on the Mount. That's what made you a Jesus follower, a Christian, a Christ follower. You tried, you endeavored to follow the teachings of this Jesus. That makes sense, doesn't it? But what do you do in the 4th century when Christianity abandons the teachings of Jesus, the ethics of Jesus, and starts to live by a radically different ethic than what Jesus taught? What defines whether or not a person is a Christian now? Constantine becomes converted. The Roman Empire and Christianity become one. The ethical teachings of Jesus become shoved out off to the margins. What defines whether someone's a Christian now? If there's no more ethics being followed, what would define whether you're a Christian? How many are familiar with the Apostles' Creed? Anyone know what that is? Yeah, I'm giving you just a little bit of Christian history so you can see where we're headed. The Apostles' Creed states that he was born of a Virgin Mary, crucified under Pontius Pilate. Did they skip anything between those two events? Anything happened between his birth and his death? What did they skip? The life and teachings of Jesus. But that no longer mattered. What defined whether you were a Christian or not is whether or not you believe in the virgin birth, whether or not you believe in the crucifixion, whether or not you believe in the resurrection. That's what made you a Christian, is whether or not you believed intellectually in story details, regardless of how you lived your life. How many are concerned when you look at modern Christianity today and how different it is from the Jesus of the Jesus story? Is there anyone here that's concerned by that besides me? Yeah, a few of you. What happened in Christianity is we began to define being a Christian by believing story details. Now, there's two problems with that. Do you know how many, now don't freak out, but do you know how many of the Gospels even mention the virgin birth? Two of them. Only two. Now, what does that mean? That means you got four versions of the Jesus story in the first century, and only two of them even mention the virgin birth. That means there were two others that told you the Jesus story, invited you to be a Jesus follower, and didn't even mention the virgin birth. What does that mean? It means for at least those two authors, they didn't think you even needed to know about the virgin birth to follow Jesus. But you know what all four of the Gospels do have? Take a guess. The ethical teachings of Jesus. Those are in all four. Are you with me so far? Are you hearing what I'm saying? It's amazing to me that because Christianity has defined being a Christian as believing in story details, do you know what's being attacked today as trying to pull people away from Christianity? Do you know what they're trying to disprove? The story details. How many are aware of what's going on in the culture today? Trying to disprove the resurrection, disprove the saying it's a lie, saying it's a legend, saying it was made up. That's what we've been talking about the whole night. It's all about story details. Whose fault is it that the discussion is now revolving around story details? Whose fault is that? It's ours. Do you know what atheists and agnostics, and I've got lots of friends that are atheists and agnostics, do you know what the most challenging thing for them is? And it's for us too. Do you know what all the scholars, nobody wants to debate this. Do you know what no one wants to argue? Take a guess at it. The ethical teachings of Jesus. Nobody wants to, because we all agree with those. How many would agree with that? We all agree with what Jesus taught, whether we agree with the story details or not. And if you were God, just stop for a moment. If you were God and you had the choice, you had to choose between one of the two, and your options were someone who believed in all the story details but ignored the ethical teachings of how Jesus taught us to live, or someone who really embraced the ethical teachings of Jesus and tried to live their lives according to the Jesus story but had some questions about whether Jesus was divine or the resurrection or the virgin birth. They just weren't persuaded fully on those. And you had to choose between one of the two and you were God. Which one of these options would you pick? Someone who was intellectually convinced of details but didn't follow the teachings, or someone who followed the teachings and had questions about the details? This one or this one, which one would you pick? Point at it. It'd be this side, wouldn't you? And yet we have millions upon millions of westernized Christians today who are fully convinced and arguing story details while they're ignoring. Listen, this is what everybody agrees with. Those ethical teachings, they've existed since the first century. We've had those since the first century. They were unborrowed. They were original. Now, teachings don't exist without a teacher. Teachings presume a teacher, whether it was a group or a person. Here's where I'm at. Can I be honest with you tonight? This is where I'm at. I don't care if the guy's name back then was Bob. Whoever it was in the first century teaching these moral ethics, these ethics have won my heart. And I say, I want to follow that guy, whoever it is teaching this stuff. Now, it just so happens that Bob was not a very common name in first century Judaism. Do you know what was a very common name? Joshua. Everybody was naming their kid Joshua because they wanted Joshua to come in and defeat the Romans and lead them into the promised land again. Every son was being named Joshua. Every daughter was being named Miriam or Mary because of the Exodus. What's the Aramaic version of Joshua? Jesus. So everybody was being named Jesus back then. Are you aware of that? Barabbas' name was Jesus. How many know that? Yeah. Everybody was being named Jesus. So is it likely that there was a guy back then named Jesus teaching this new moral ethic to this group of people? Is that possible? Yes. So what we're going to be looking at over the next 7 days, again, we are not going to be debating story details. How many are thankful for that? We're not going to be trying to push story details. All we're looking at is the ethical teachings of Jesus, found specifically in what the version of the Jesus story that we have, it calls the Sermon on the Mount, and asking if the teachings of Jesus hold any relevance to the five areas of our life today that we desperately want more in. We want financial peace. We want relational healing. We want intellectual understanding. We want spiritual fulfillment. We want better health. Do the ethical teachings of Jesus have anything to say about those five areas of life? And if they do, then you may never become an evangelical Christian. Are you hearing what I'm saying? But you may become a Jesus follower. I'm not saying, well, I won't even go that far. If that challenges you, chew on that. It's not about following a religion. It's about following a person. If you agree with that, say yes. And so for the next 7 days, again, all we're going to be looking at are the teachings of Jesus and asking, is there anything in those teachings that I resonate with, that makes sense to me? And if they do, hear me. What if it's not about gaining post-mortem heaven or escaping some subterranean hell? What if it's not about that? What if it's not about, and just hear me out, religiously being saved or lost? What if it's about being a part of the cure versus part of the disease? See, Jesus came to this planet. The version of the Jesus story that we have, the Jesus we find in this Jesus story, is of an itinerant preacher calling people to enter into a radical reorientation in how we do life in the here and now. He wasn't going around trying to get people to say a special prayer so that when they died, they could go to heaven. You realize that is strangely absent from the Jesus story. How many have noticed that? It's just not there. But Jesus did go around calling people to a radical reorientation in how we do life in the here and now. And that radical reorientation was based upon three significant paradigm shifts. Number one, a change in how we see God. Number two, a change in how we see ourselves. And number three, a change in how we looked at everyone else around us. This is where we're headed. We're going to take an open-minded look at these ethics that Jesus gave us and ask, do they make sense? Is there anything inside of me that resonates? And do I think that there's hope for the world if we learn to follow that? Thank you so much for being here tonight. How many are excited that you're here? How many want to go invite a friend? Good, good, good. That's a lot of hands. That's the most hands I got all night. Yeah, go invite a friend. Invite your friends tomorrow night. We're going to be looking at if God is so good. I was on a plane a couple years ago where we were talking about the difference between Christianity and Jesus. And the guy, about 6 hours into the plane ride, long plane ride, he looked at me finally and said, okay, fine. Let's say there is a God out there. And let's say he does look like Jesus. He said, can you explain to me then if there's a God out there that looks like Jesus? He said, this was his words, not mine. He said, then why is the suck factor of my life so high? Anyone identify with what he's asking? He's saying, if God is so good, then why is all this garbage happening to me in my life if God looks like that Jewish carpenter 2,000 years ago? That's where we're headed tomorrow night. What did Jesus have to say about that? We'll begin there right at 6:30. Once again, thanks for being here. Be safe going home. Thank you so much. Invite a friend tomorrow, and we'll see you then. God bless you.